Hello guys, welcome back to another episode of Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. Let's get into it.
Hi there. Welcome to Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. I am Habiba Shehu. On today's episode of Book Club, I'll be reading Book 2, Chapter 1 to 3 of The Famished Road. Make sure to follow Moti Nigeria on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening from. And if you like my voice, do check me out on Instagram at beeptease_inc. Enjoy!
The world is full of riddles that only the dead can answer. When I began to go to Madame Cotter's place, I understood why the spirits were curious about her. I went to her bar in the afternoons after school. She was often in the backyard. She was often digging the earth, planting a secret or taking one out. One day I hid and watched her and saw her plant round white stones in the earth. I did not know their significance or even if they had any. Sometimes when I came in from school, she would be in the bushes in the backyard, and as soon as she heard me, she would shout, sit down and attract customers, draw them here. I would sit and swat flies. The palm wine everywhere made the flies so plentiful that sometimes when I inhaled, I was sure I breathed them in as well. I would sit in the empty bar, near the earthenware pot, and would watch passerby through the cotton strips. At first, when I sat there alone, no one came to drink, and it seemed as if I was bringing more bad luck than good. In the afternoons, the bar was empty. One or two people who had no jobs would come in and haggle over the price of a glass of palm wine. The moment someone came into the bar, Madame Cotter treated them respectfully. What she hated was people standing outside uncertain. She preferred them to go away rather than come in. She was very decided in their respect. Women sometimes came by in the afternoons. They were mostly hawkers of sun-bleached goods. They talked about their children or their husbands or about the forthcoming elections and about the thugs and violence, the people of different parties killed in skirmishes deep in the country. The women always came with bundles on their heads. They often looked both sad and robust, or spirited and lean. Many of them were hawkers on their way to the market or just stopping to get some shade and some respite from the dusty ghetto paths. They talked in high-pitched voices and congregated round Madame Cotter in the backyard as she sat on a stool preparing the evening's pepper soup. When the women came by, they always teased me, saying, "There is the boy who would marry my daughter. Look at him. He has been trained in the ways of women." They all had children strapped to their backs. The ways of women. I learned a lot about what was happening in the country through them. I learned about the talk of independence, about how the white men treated us, about political parties and tribal divisions. I would sit in the bar, on a bench, with my feet never touching the floor, and would listen to their stories of lurid sexual scandals as sleep touched my eyes with the noonday heat. It was always hot, and the flies and wall geckos, the gnats and midges were always active. The women would talk very well. Madame Cotter would buy a thing or two from them and they would set out on the hot roads, touching me or smiling as they went. Sometimes Madame Cotter would vanish altogether and leave me in the empty bar. Customers would come in and I would stare at them and they at me. "Any palm wine?" "Yes." "Serve us then." I wouldn't move. "You don't want to serve us?" I wouldn't move. "Where is your madame?" "I don't know." They would wander off to the backyard and come back and sit for a while. "What is your name?" I wouldn't tell them. They would leave disgusted and I wouldn't see them again for a long time afterwards. When Madame Cotter returned and I told her about the customers, she spoke harshly to me. "Why didn't you come and call me?" "Where?" "In my room." "Where?" "Come." She showed it to me. That was when I realized she had a room in the compound. Her room was near the toilet. She never let me in and the door was always locked. I also learned that in the afternoons she often went to the market to buy ingredients for the evening's cooking, finding the right herbs for her flavored pepper soup. Sometimes she bought ground tobacco and rolled it around in her mouth all afternoon long. One afternoon I was sitting in my customary position when the earthenware pot began to rattle. I put my hands on it and it stopped. I took my hands off and it rattled. I went to the backyard, looking around for some sort of explanation. When I came back, I saw, standing in the doorway, three of the strangest looking men. They were unusually tall and very black. Their eyes were almond-shaped and they had small noses. Their arms were quite short and the smiles on their faces never altered. They spoke among themselves in nasal voices that sounded as if they had no chest. I couldn't understand what they said. They refused to move from the doorway. They looked around the bar, inspecting it, studying the place, each facing a separate direction, as if their different heads connected a central intelligence. Their eyes were deep and dull and confusing. I could not be sure at any given moment if they were looking at me or at the ceiling. I indicated the benches. They shook their heads simultaneously. They just stood there, completely blocking out the light from the door. I looked at their short arms, limp at their sides, and my head nearly fell off in fright when I discovered that all of them, without exception, had six fingers on each hand. Then I noticed that they were barefoot, and their toes were interned like those of certain animals. They radiated a potent and frightening dignity. I got down from the bench and ran to Madame Cote's room and shouted that she had three strange customers. She bustled out towards the bar, tightening her wrap around her, spitting out the ground tobacco in her mouth. When I got there, she was outside. I looked around. The flies and wall geckos had gone. A black cat peeped at me from the backyard door. I went after it and it leapt over the wall of the compound. I went to the bar front and couldn't find Madame Cote. I went into the bar and she was wiping the tabletops with a wet rag, saying, "I didn't see anybody. Call me only when customers arrive, you hear?" I didn't nod or say anything. After Mom recovered from her illness, she became sadder and leaner and more sober. Each morning when she woke up from sleep, she went around the room as if something had knocked her out the night before and she could not place what it had been. Dad took to going to bed late and waking early. When I got up in the mornings, he had gone off to look for jobs. Mom would putter about the room, muttering to herself about rats and poverty. On some mornings, I woke to the commotion of Mom trashing the cupboard with a broom. She lashed at the cupboard, whipped underneath it, flogged her basins of provision and sacks of gari as if they had personally offended her. Sometimes cockchafers scattered everywhere under her lashing and they clambered onto my face and I would jump up. Mom, oblivious, wreaking vengeance, would carry on lashing them. She would sweep their corpses onto a pan, dump the broom, go out to dispose of the cockchafers, and we would settle down to eat. She always gave me some bread to take to school and she always walked me as far as the junction and then carried on, basin balanced on her head, through the streets, crooning out her provision. For a while, Dad disappeared from my life. I woke up and he wouldn't be there. I went to sleep and he wouldn't have returned. He worked very hard and when I saw him on Sundays, he seemed to be in agony. His back always hurt and in the evenings, me and Mom had to walk on him to ease the pain. His back was very strong and rigid, and I could never balance on it. When Mom trod on him, his spine creaked and we took to rubbing him with a foul-smelling ointment we got from an itinerant herbalist. Dad worked hard, carrying heavy loads at the garage and marketplaces, and he earned very little money. Out of what he earned, he paid the creditors who came to our room every evening to remind us that they were still alive. And out of what was left, we could barely manage to pay the rent and eat. After some days of not seeing Dad, I asked Mom what happened to him. "He's working for our food," she said. It was night. Children played in the passage. Inside, we had no light because we couldn't afford a candle. Mom moved about in the darkness in uncomplaining silence. She kicked something and cursed and sat down and I lit a match and saw blood pouring out from the big toe of her right foot. "The right foot is supposed to be lucky," she said. The blood dripped to the floor and I said, "Shall I boil water?" She said nothing. The match burned down to my fingers. Her blood became the color of the darkness. I couldn't hear her breathe, couldn't see her. And before I could light another match, she got up and limped to the backyard. When she came back, she had washed the cut and I asked her what she had put on it. "Poverty," she said. I lit another match and studied the toe. "Don't waste the matches," she said sharply. The cut still bled through the black stuff she had covered it with. "Ash," she said. The light went out. We didn't move. The rats began to chew and the cockchafers began to stir in the cupboard. "Time for you to sleep," she said. I didn't move. I wanted to stay awake till Dad returned. It grew late and dark. After a while, I had Mom say, "I'm going to warm the food." We hadn't eaten since the morning.
We had been going to sleep on empty stomachs for days. I'm coming with you. Go to sleep or a ghost will grab you. Let it try. She moved in the dark and I heard her at the door. Light came in and Mom went out. I sat in the darkness, listening. I tried to get up but something held me down. I tried to move but the darkness had become a resistant force. I lowered myself to the floor and crawled around on my hands and knees. Something crawled up my arm. I made to get up, frightened, and hit my head against the sharp edge of the center table and I stayed like that till the darkness stopped dancing. Then I searched for Dad's chair and sat down. I could see the outline of things. I stayed there till Mom came in. You're still up? Yes. Go to sleep. I'm hungry. She was silent. Then after a while she said, wait for your father. We will all share his food. I thanked her. She found me in the darkness and held my head to her and I heard her crying gently and then she said in a lighter voice, let me tell you a story about the stomach. Tell me a story, I said expectantly. She went back to the bed. I couldn't see her. The rats ate and the cockchafers fretted. She began, powerful people eat very little, she said. Why? Because they are powerful. There was once a great medicine man in my village who would fly to the moon at night and then would walk across the mighty ocean to visit spirits in the country of white people. Why? Because he went to attend an important meeting concerning the future of the whole world. And to be able to attend the meeting, he must do something great. So he flew to the moon and to many planets. After he had done that, he went to the country of white people and before they allowed him in, they asked him one question. What? They said, Mr. Medicine Man from the village of Otu, what did you eat before you went to the moon? And what did he say? A cricket. Only a cricket? Yes, a small roasted cricket. We were silent for a while. I pondered the story with my feet not touching the floor. Is that the story of the stomach? No, Mom said in the darkness. We were silent again. Then Mom began saying, once upon a time, I sat back in Dad's chair and folded up my feet. There was a man without a stomach. Every year he used to worship at a great shrine. One day he met a stomach without a body. The stomach said, I have been looking for you. What are you doing without me? And then the stomach jumped on the man and became part of him. The man carried on with his journey to the shrine. But before he got there, he became very hungry. The stomach said, feed me. I will not, said the man. When I didn't have you, I traveled far, was never hungry, was always happy and contented, and I was strong. You can either leave me now or be quiet. Somewhere around that point in the story, I fell through the back of the chair and I flew on the back of a cricket, and I was the man without a stomach, heading for a feast on the moon. And then I found my eyes open and there was a candle lit on the table. Dad was standing above me, swaying. He looked both crushed and stunned. My brain has been pressed down, my son, he said. I quickly got down from his chair. He paced up and down the room holding his head. And then he sat down heavily and was still. I found the candle at the market, he said and fell asleep. Mom laid out his food and woke him up. He blinked. I have been carrying the most terrible loads in my dreams, he groaned. You should eat, Mom said. We had gathered round the table. Dad didn't move. His face was lit by the candle. All the tendons on his neck showed up thick and tense. His face glistened, and his veins throbbed on his temples. He surprised us by suddenly speaking. They had begun to spoil everything with politics, he said in a ghostly and exhausted voice. Now they want to know who you will vote for before they let you carry their load. He paused. His eyes were bloodshot. If you want to vote for that party that supports the poor, they give you the heaviest load. I am not much better than a donkey. Eat. You're tired, Mom said. Dad shut his eyes and began mumbling something which I took to be a prayer. He didn't open his eyes for a long time, and it was only when he began to snore that we knew he had fallen asleep again. Mom didn't want to disturb him a second time, so we ate half of the food and saved the rest for him to eat in the morning. We ate more quietly than the rats did. Before I woke up in the morning, Dad had gone and all I had of him were the smells of his boots, of mud, of cigarettes, of mosquito coil and his sweat. The mood of the room was infected with his exhaustion. We had cut down our food. That morning we had pap and bread. Mom went off to the market, went hawking her boxes of matches, sweets, cigarettes, and odds and ends down the road on a quite empty stomach. She looked much leaner and her blouse hung from her and straps fell over her shoulders as if she had shrunk in her clothes. As I walked behind her to the junction where we parted, I felt very unhappy about the thinness of her voice amongst the noises of the ghetto. As she went off on her arduous journeys, she seemed so frail that the slightest wind threatened to blow her away into the molten sky. Before she went, she gave me a piece of bread and told me to behave myself at school. I followed her a short way. She was barefoot. It pained me to see her stumble on the rubbish and stones of the path. It seemed very harsh not to be able to go hawking with her, not to be able to protect her feet and help her sell off all her provisions. I followed her and then she turned, saw me and waved me on to school. I slowed down, turned back, and watched her disappear into the expanding ghetto. When I went to Madame Couture's bar after school, the place was empty. I was hungry. Sitting near the earthenware pot, I kept telling myself that I didn't have a stomach. I slept and woke up. Flies had come into the bar. I went to Madame Couture's room to ask for food and was about to knock when I heard her chanting. I heard the ringing of a bell. I was about to go back to the bar when two women of the compound saw me and said, "What are you doing?" I said nothing. They held me and I shouted. Madame Couture came out. She had antimony on one side of her face, kaolin on the other, and her mouth was full of the juice of ground tobacco. The women looked at her, then at one another, and hurried on. "Why didn't you knock?" she asked, her mouth dripping with the tobacco. "You were busy. Go to the bar." "I'm hungry." "How can you be hungry with that small stomach?" Then she went back to her room. The bell started up. I went to the bar and the flies played around my nose. It got very humid and I couldn't breathe and my hunger was unbearable. I went out of the bar and wandered along the path. It was excruciatingly hot. Trees shimmered in the sun. The shadows were dense. Insects sizzled among the bushes. A lizard half crossed my way and then it stopped, turned towards me and nodded. A bell rang. Its jangling noise scared me and I jumped out of the path into the bushes and a huge man with a wide mouth rode past on a little bicycle. He gave an insane laugh as he shot past. I stayed in the bushes and only came running out when I felt my legs burning with stings. I had trodden on an army of ants. I got them off me and was about to return to the bar when I noticed that the poor lizard was dead in the middle of the path. The bicycle had ridden over it and it had died with its head cut in an exaggerated knot. The ants marched towards it and I picked up the lizard by the tail and took it with me towards the bar, intent on giving it a good burial. Outside the bar, there was a man standing barefoot in the heat. He had on only a pair of sad-looking underpants. His hair was rough and covered in a red liquid and bits of rubbish. He had a big saw on his back and a small one on his ear. Flies swarmed around him and he kept twitching. Every now and then he broke into a titter. I tried to go around him, but he kept cutting off my path. "Madame Couture," I called. The man came towards me. He had one eye higher than the other. His mouth looked like a festering wound. He twitched, stamped, laughed, and suddenly ran into the bar. I went after him, carrying the dead lizard as if it were a protective fetish. I found him crouched behind the earthenware pot. He snarled at me. "Madame Couture," I called again. The madman jittered, baring his red teeth. And then he rushed at me. I threw the dead lizard in his face. He laughed, screamed, and fell on the benches, tittering in demented delight. He got up, walked in every direction, oblivious of objects, knocking over the long wooden tables and the benches. He came after me. I ran in circles. He scuttled round the floor like a monstrous quickened crab. With the exhilarated animation of a child, he discovered the dead lizard and began playing with it. He sat on an upturned table, his eyes making contradictory journeys round their sockets. Then he began to eat the lizard. "Madame Couture!" I screamed with the full volume of my horror. She came rushing in, holding a new broom. She saw the confusion in her bar, saw the madman eating the lizard, twitching and tittering, and she pounced on him, hitting him with the head of the long broom, as if he were a cow or a goat. The madman didn't move. He ate with weird serenity. Madame Couture knocked the lizard from his hands. Then, tying her wrapper tighter around her waist, She went for his neck with her big hands. He turned his head towards me, his eyes bulging. White foam frothed from the side of his mouth. Then, with a sudden burst of energy and a cry uttered at white heat, he tossed Madame Koto off him, stood up straight like an awakened beast, and charged at everything. He fought and clawed the air, uttering his weird cry. Then he changed. He brought out his gigantic brick and pissed in every direction. Madame Koto hit his prick with her broom. He pissed on her. She rushed out and came back with a burning firewood. She burned his feet, and he did a galloping dance and jumped around and tore out of the bar and ran tittering towards the forest. Madame Koto looked around her wrecked bar. She looked at the burning firewood in her hand and she stared at me. "What sort of child are you?" she asked. I began to pick up the benches. "Maybe you only bring bad luck," she said. "Since you have been coming, my old customers have gone and there are no new ones." "I'm hungry," I said. "Attract customers. Draw them here and you will have food," she said, going back to the backyard. Later, she took the benches and tables outside and scrubbed them with a special soap. She swept the bar and washed the place with a concentrated disinfectant. She brought the tables and benches back in when the sun had dried them and then went to have a bath, all she always had before the evening customers arrived. When she finished bathing, she came to the bar with a bowl of pepper soup and yam. She slammed it down and said, "Since you're so hungry, you better finish it." I thanked her and she went back out. I washed a spoon and settled down to eat. The soup was very hot and I drank a lot of water. The yam was soft and sweet. There were pieces of meat and offal in the soup and I had almost eaten them all before I realized that one of the pieces was actually a chicken's head. The pepper burned in my brain and I was convinced that the chicken's head was eyeing me. Madame Koto came in carrying a fetish glistening with palm oil. She dragged a bench under the front door, climbed on it, and hung the fetish on a nail above the door. I noticed for the first time that she had a little beard. "I don't like chicken's head," I told her. "Eat it. It's good for your brain. It makes you clever, and if you eat the eyes, you'll be able to see in the dark." I didn't eat it. She came down, dragged the bench back in its position, and stood in front of me. "Eat it," she said. "I'm not hungry anymore." Madame Koto regarded me. She had rubbed pungent oils on her skin. She looked radiant and powerful. The oil smelled bad, and I think they were one of the reasons why the spirits were interested in her. "So you won't eat it?" I knew she would become angry and would never give me food in the future if I didn't eat it. So reluctantly, and hating every moment of it, I did. I cracked the chicken's head with my teeth. I broke its beak. I swallowed down its red comb. I scraped off the thin layer of flesh on its crown. "What about the eyes?" I sucked out the eyes and chewed them and spat them out on the floor. "Pick them up." I picked up the eyes, cleared the table, and went to wash the plate. When I got back, she had set down a glass of her best palm wine for me. I sat in a corner, near the earthenware pot, and drank peacefully. "That's how to be a man," she said. The palm wine got to me fairly quickly, and I dozed sitting upright. I woke up when some rowdy customers came in. They smelled of raw meat and animal blood. "Palm wine," one of them shouted. Flies congregated round new customers. Madame Koto brought them a great gourd of wine. They drank the lot very quickly and the evening's heat increased their smells. They got rowdier. They argued furiously amongst themselves about politics. Madame Koto tried to calm them down, but they ignored her altogether. They argued with passionate ferocity in an incomprehensible language, and the fiercer they got, the more they stank. One of them whipped out a knife. The other two fell on him. In the confusion, they scattered the table and benches, broke the gourd and glasses, and managed to disarm the man. When they had put the knife away, one of them cried, "More palm wine!" Madame Koto went out and fetched her broom. They saw the violence on her face. "No more palm wine," she said, "and pay for what you have broken." They paid without any complaints, and went out again as vigorously as they had been doing. I went back to my corner and finished my glass of palm wine. Madame Koto poured me some more. The aroma of her rich scented pepper soup floated in from the backyard. The evening wore on and customers drifted in. Odd customers. A man came in who was solidly drunk already. He kept cursing and swearing. "Look at that toad," he said about me. "Look at that fat woman with a beard," he said about Madame Koto. Then he rushed outside, came back, and asked for a gourd of palm wine. When he was served, he drank quietly, occasionally pecking up to abuse everything. He abused the lizards, flies, the bench, and the ceiling. Then he fell quiet again and drank peacefully. Another customer came in who was so totally cross-eyed that I began to feel cross-eyed myself from staring at him. "What are you looking at?" he demanded angrily.
"Your eyes," I said.
"Why?
Haven't you got eyes of your own?"
"Yes, but I can't see them." He came over and knocked me on the head. I kicked him on the shin bone. He knocked me again, harder, and I rushed out and grabbed Madame Couture's broom and came in and hit him on the head with it. He cried out. He backed off. I hit him again. The drunken man began to curse. He abused cross-eyed people, abused brooms, swore at children, and became quiet. Madame Couture came in and seized the broom from me. I sat down. "Serve me palm wine," the cross-eyed man said, "and warn that boy of yours. He has been insulting my eyes."
"What's wrong with your eyes?" Madame Couture asked, staring intensely at him.
He didn't reply, and he sat down into a moody silence. After he had been served, he drank a great quantity in one go, looked at me, found me staring at him, and then he turned away, trying to hide his eyes from me.
"Serve me pepper soup," he shouted.
Madame Couture served him and he devoured the meat and drank the soup very fast. "Tell that boy not to stare at me," he said.
"Why?"
He drank some more palm wine and peered over his shoulder at me. His eyes interested me. One of them was green. Looking at the green eye had a strange effect on me.
"I'll give you money if you look somewhere else," he said.
"How much?" Trying to hide his face, he came over and emptied all his spare change on the table. I pocketed it and watched him go back to his seat. He kept checking up on me. I had taken my eyes off him, but it was hard to look anywhere else after the experience of seeing him. His eyes, in their strangeness, were magnetic. I kept my eyes off him and looked around the bar and noticed green patches on the floor. I couldn't understand where they came from. I drank some more palm wine. The alarming realization that the green patches were the stains of the madman's piece was beginning to dawn on me when the lights changed in the bar and the drunken man cursed, and from the floor there rose a host of green spirits. They rose up and they grew till their heads touched the ceiling, and then they shrank till they were no taller than the average chicken. They were all cross-eyed. They milled around the areas of the madman's piece and they stamped and made swarming noises. Everywhere I looked, I saw cross-eyed spirits. I cried out and the drunken man abused the moon, and Madame Couture came and took me outside and gave me some water and alligator pepper to chew. "You should go home now," she said. I was silent. "Have some fresh air, then go." I stayed outside for a while. The moon was out in the sky. It was big, clear, and white. It was white. Then it became silver, and I saw things moving on its face, and I couldn't stop staring because it was so beautiful and so low in the dark blue sky. I watched it for a long time, and sweet voices stirred in my ears, and Madame Couture came out and said, "What are you doing?" She looked up, saw the moon, and said, "Why are you looking at the moon? Haven't you seen a moon before?" "Not like this one. Come in, take your things and go home, it's getting late." I pulled myself away from the moon and went back into the bar with her. The bar was full of the oddest people. There was a man in the corner who said loudly that he had just come back from Hitler's war. No one believed him. "Hitler died years ago," someone said. "I killed him," said the loud man.
"How?"
"I used a special juju. I blew pepper in his eyes and his mustache stood up, and I killed him with this knife." He whisked out a knife, brandished it, and no one seemed concerned. In another corner, a man kept tossing his head. Another man snorted. There was a younger man next to the drunk. He had a bright scar down his face. The drunk cursed and stopped and cursed again. The green cross-eyed spirits mingled with the clientele, and one of the spirits climbed the wall like a new kind of lizard and studied Madame Couture's fetish. It was a very odd night. The bar saw its most unusual congregation of the weird, the drunk, the mad, the wounded, and the wonderful. Madame Couture weaved her way through them all with the greatest serenity. She seemed fully protected and entirely fearless. I think she made a lot of money that night, because as I was leaving, she did something rare. She smiled at me. She was happy and graceful amidst all the bustle. She gave me a piece of uncooked yam, and I took the expanding pats back home to Mom.
You're still listening to the Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. Book club continues.
Ah, Our room was crowded. Mom was back early. She looked sun-eaten and tired. Sitting disdainfully on Dad's chair with his feet on the table was the landlord. Sitting on the bed, standing round the room, were the creditors and their relations. They looked angry and helpless. Everyone was silent when I came in. I went over to Mom. She put her arms around me and said, "You all have to be patient." "How can we be patient?" said one of the creditors. The others nodded vigorously. "Patience will kill us. We have to eat and trade."
"True.
But we have paid most of the money," Mom said. "But not all." "And not in 1 week," added the landlord. "Patience doesn't kill." "Nonsense," said the creditor. "Patience is killing my son. You think I will pay the native doctor patience?" The landlord laughed and brought out a colonel from his voluminous robe. He ate it alone. I watched his lips turn reddish. Mom was silent, and as the landlord munched away on his colonel, the rat started chewing. I looked round at the creditors as if their presence had robbed me of food. I said nothing. "Look at his big stomach," the landlord said of me, chuckling. "Leave my son alone." "All we want is our money," one of the creditors said, staring at me. "I don't have your money," I said. "This boy is worse than his father." Mom stood up suddenly. "If you have come to insult us, leave our room," she said. She shut the door and the window. It became dark in the room and Mom refused to light the candle. Every now and again, the landlord lit a match and looked at everyone. The rats ate louder and Mom launched into a song of lamentation. The creditors didn't move. The landlord went on chewing. When Mom stopped singing, the silence became deeper. We remained in the silence and the gloom till there was a knock on the door. "Who is it?" "The photographer." "What do you want?" "The photographs are ready." "So what? Don't you want to see them?" The landlord got up and opened the door. He stayed in the doorway, looking at the pictures with the help of the photographer's touch. Then he came into the room. The photographer trailed behind him, a camera on his shoulder. "They are good," the landlord said, passing the torch and the pictures round. The creditors became animated and talked about images of the celebration, how so-and-so looked drunk, how that person's eyes were shut like a roots. Then the landlord said, as the photographs came back to him, "Why is Madame Koto's face like that?" Madame Koto's face was smudged. She looked like a washed-out monster, a cross between a misbegotten animal and a wood carving. "She's a witch," one of the creditors said. "She is not," I said. "Shut up," said Mom. When I looked closer at the pictures, we all seemed strange. The pictures were grained. There were dots over our faces, smudges everywhere. Dad looked as if he had a patch over one eye. Mom was blurred in both eyes. The children were like squirrels, and I resembled a rabbit. We all looked like celebrating refugees. We were cramped and hungry, and our smiles were fixed. The room appeared to be constructed out of garbage, and together we seemed a people who had never known happiness. Those of us that smiled had our faces contorted into grimaces, like people who had been defeated but who smile when a camera is trained on them. The photographer was very pleased with the results and quoted prizes for copies. One of the creditors said he would get his copy when Dad paid up. The landlord said, "I look like a chief." "Thief," I said. Mom knocked me on my head. "Your son looks like a goat," the landlord said. The creditors laughed. Mom said, "We want to sleep now. Everyone should leave." "Is that how you talk to your landlord?" "Okay, everyone should stay," Mom said. "Azaro, prepare your bed." I got up in the dark, moved to the center table and unrolled my mat. I lay down. The creditor's feet were all around my head. The landlord went on chewing. After a brief silence, one of the creditors said, "All right, if I can't get my money now, I'm going to see something." He got up from the bed, lifted the center table and went to the door. "Good night, landlord," he said and left. Mom didn't move. Another creditor, asking the landlord to light a match for him, took Dad's boots. The third one said, "I won't take anything, but I will keep coming back." The photographer said, "I'll come tomorrow." The landlord said, "Tell your husband I want to see him." Then they all left. Mom got out of bed and warmed some food for Dad. When she finished, she counted the money she had made that day. She put some aside for buying provisions and some towards the rent. The candle was low, and as it burned towards the end, its poor illumination showed up Mom's bony face. her hardening eyes, and the veins on her neck. I saw a mad boy today. They tied him to a chair and his mother was crying. What happened to him? How should I know? We were quiet. How is Madame Koto? She is fine. Does she ask about me? No. What does she do all the time?
She stays in her room. Today she had a lot of strange customers. She put up a juju on the wall. A madman came into the bar and ate a lizard and pissed everywhere. If it's like that, you must stop going there.
I don't want to.
Why not?
I don't want to.
How was school?
I don't like school.
You must like school. If your father had gone to school, we wouldn't be suffering so much. Learn all you can learn. This is a new age. Independence is coming. Only those who go to school can eat good food. Otherwise, you will end up carrying loads like your father. We were silent again. You must be careful of Madame Koto.
Why?
People have been saying things about her. We don't know where she comes from. And that juju of hers, who made it?
I don't know. Don't touch it.
I won't touch it. But what did they say about her?
You're a small boy. You won't understand.
Tell me. Go to sleep.
Did she kill someone?
Go to sleep. We fell silent and Mom put away her basin of provisions and her money. She hadn't made much and the sourness of her face told me she was wondering whether walking the streets of the world day after boiling day, crooning out her provisions till her voice was hers, was worth the little she earned at the end of it all. She sighed and I knew that in spite of everything, she would carry on hawking. Her sigh was full of despair, but at the bottom of her lungs, at the depth of her breath's expulsion, there was also hope, waiting like sleep at the end of even the most torrid days. As I drifted in the corridors of sleep, I heard a great loud voice singing from the gateway of the compound. The voice was rough and drunken. Another voice cried, "Black Tiger!" Dad kicked open the door and staggered into the room like a dreaded announcement. Mom jumped up and hurriedly lit a reserve candle. Her brightened face was tinged with uncertainty. Dad stood in the doorway like a drunken giant. His shoulders were hunched. He held a bottle of Ogogoro in one hand. Both of his trousers' legs were covered in mud up to the knees. He had on only one shoe. The room stank of drunkenness and mud. His neck creaked, twisting his mouth. Blinking as if reality were blinding him, he said very loudly, "I am going to join the army." And then he collapsed into a heap on the floor. We rushed over to help him up. He revived quickly, saw us struggling over him, and shoved us away. I was sent flying to the corner where his shoes used to be. Mom tumbled onto the bed. He staggered up, weaved, snatched up his bottle of Ogogoro, took a deep drink and said, "How is my family?" "We are well," replied Mom.
"Good. Now I have some money. We can pay off the bastard creditors. We can pay off everybody, and then I'll shoot them."
He made an exaggerated imitation of a machine gun.
"Aren't you hungry?" asked Mom.
"I fell into mud," said Dad.
"I was coming down the road, drinking, singing, and then the road said to me, 'Watch yourself.' So I abused the road. Then it turned into a river, and I swam. It changed into fire, and I sweated. It transformed into a tiger and I killed it with one blow. And then it shrunk into a big rat and I shouted at it and it ran like the creditors. And then it dissolved into mud and I lost my shoe. If I had money, I would be a great man."
We stared at him in fear and confusion. He weaved a bit, stretched his back and staggered towards his chair. He did not sit down but stood regarding the chair as if it were an enemy.
"You're looking at me, chair," he said. "You don't want me to sit on you, eh? Because I fell in mud? Isn't that correct?"
The chair said nothing.
"I'm talking to you, chair. Are you better than my bed? I talk to you and you move. What do you think you are, eh?"
The chair pondered the question for too long, so Dad kicked it with his shoeless foot. He cried out and looked at the chair again.
"Sit on the bed," Mom said. Dad looked at her venomously. Then he turned back to the chair.
"Be still," he said, with great authority. The chair was still. "That's better. Now I'm going to sit on you whether I'm covered in mud or even in gold, you hear? And if you move, I'll beat you up."
He paused. "They don't call me Black Tiger for nothing." Then he sat down heavily and the chair creaked so loudly that for a moment I thought it would disintegrate under his drunkenness. The chair wobbled, and for some reason Dad wobbled with it. and then he got up and grabbed it and flung it against the window. The chair clattered on the floor and the window flew open. Mosquitoes and midges invaded us and the lizards scurried up the wall and rats scattered from underneath the cupboard and ran confused about the room. Dad went wild, grabbing at the chair and lashing at the rats. He pursued them everywhere and banged his head against the cupboard. A rat fled towards the door and he chased it, dumping the chair, stamping, making machine gun noises. He stayed outside for a while, and Mom picked up the chair and put it upright in its customary position. After a long while, Dad came back in with someone else's wrap around his waist. He had bathed, and water dripped from his hair and he looked like a deranged boxer. His trousers were over his shoulder. Dad came in quietly, his eyes bright, and he looked at us furtively, as though we might be angry with him. He drank some water and attempted to shut the window, but it wouldn't shut. He tried again. He raised a fist against it and sat slowly in the chair. He got up suddenly, ducking his head, throwing combination punches. Then he struggled into a pair of khaki trousers. His chest was bare and he was sweating already and his body glistened. Dad looked very powerful. His shoulders were big and molded like rock shapes. His neck was thick. I had never noticed that his jaws were so square and his forehead so large. His nose was bigger than I remembered and he had a bristly growth of beard. His muscles rippled impressively. His transformation surprised me. He was very restless and he kept moving, kept straying left and right, hooks in the air. He was oblivious of us. We watched him intently. He looked rough and wild. Eventually, he sat down again and shut his eyes. Then he jerked his head up and looked around. The candlelight made his face fierce. To the ceiling, he said, "I carried loads today till I thought my neck and my back and my soul would break." Then I threw down the load and said, "Never again." But I earned nothing, and I have a family to feed. And I carried the load and said, "There must be another way of earning money." And I thought, "I will join the army." And then later I saw Aku, our relative, and I borrowed some money from him. He was silent again, and he shut his eyes. "How is Aku?" "Fine." "And his wife?" "Well, did you see their children?" "No." Then Dad raised his feet to rest them as usual on the center table. His feet hung in the air. "What happened to the table?" he asked, opening his eyes, his feet still in the air. "It was here when I came in." He dropped his feet and began to look for the center table. He looked around the room under the bed behind the cupboard. He went outside and came back in again. We were silent. "Where is the table?" We said nothing. He glared at me and then at Mom as if we had been playing high tricks on him. "Where is it? Did it walk away? Did you people hide it? Did you sell it to buy food? Was it stolen? What happened to it, eh?" He got agitated. His muscles rippled restlessly on his chest. His jaws worked furiously. Our silence angered him even further and Mom was forced to tell him what had happened. Then Dad truly went wild. He growled like an enraged lion, drew himself up to his fullest titanic height, stormed out of the room and began raging down the passage so loudly that it seemed as though thunder had descended amongst us. He woke up the whole compound with his fury. He banged on the doors of the creditors and strode up and down the passage demanding back his property that the creditors had stolen from him. The children woke up and began crying. Lights came on in the rooms and one by one people appeared at their doors with startled expression on their faces. Some of the men had matches and one man had a Dane gun. The women went around saying, "What has happened?" Their husbands called them back harshly. Dad went on raging, accusing the creditors of robbing him of his entire property. One of them came out and said, "I didn't take anything. I said I would wait for you to get back." "Who stole my furniture then?" The creditor stuttered and said, "I didn't take anything." Dad counted out some money, gave it to him, and went on mounting his towering campaign against the other two. "They're hiding now behind their wife's wrapper and yet in broad daylight they threatened my wife and son and stole all my things. They are rats, cowards, thieves and rogues. Let them come out and deny it." When the compound people understood what was going on, they went back to their rooms. The lights went out one by one. One of the two eldest tenants came out to try and settle matters. Dad didn't listen to them and went on shouting. One or two men hidden in the darkness of their room said, "It's Black Tiger. He is strong." "Yes, I am drunk," Dad said loudly, "but it doesn't stop me cursing the armed robbers." He went on to demand that the creditors return his furniture to his room immediately or he would break down their doors and burn the house. "He's mad," someone said. "Yes, I am mad. I am a mad tiger and I will burn everything down if those armed robbers don't return my things now." the two elders made another attempt at conciliation. Then they tried to hold him down. Dad tossed them off and went on raging like a dangerous animal. Somewhere in the compound, a husband and wife began quarreling. After a while, a door opened and one of the creditors came out timidly, carrying the center table, with his head hung low. He crept to our room and Dad's voice raged over him in utter scorn. The creditor dropped the center table outside our door and he was creeping back to his room when Dad blocked his way and said, "Is that where you found it, eh? You thief." "I'm not a thief. You owe me money. Is that where you found it?" The creditor turned back and picked up the table. I was about to open the door for him, but Dad shouted, "Don't open the door for that coward." So the creditor dropped the table, opened the door, went in with the table and came out again. "What about my money?" he asked in a low voice as he passed Dad. There was a brief silence, then Dad threw his money on the floor. "There is your money, coward." The creditor looked from the money on the floor to Dad, who towered over him. Then he bent down and picked up the money. "Money will kill you," Dad said. "You drank of my beer, ate of my food, and because of a small amount of money, you behaved like a rat." The creditor scurried off to his room and locked his door. The noise of him quarreling with his wife continued. After some time, their light went out. Dad stood shiplessly in the middle of the passage, a little diminished for lack of confrontation. He was returning to our room when the other creditor came creeping out with the pair of boots. "You too!" Dad cried, resuming his charged state. "So you stole my boots." The third creditor ran to our room, dropped the boots, and came out. Dad stood in front of him, feet solidly planted. There was silence. The cocks crowed. Then Dad threw his money on the floor, and the third creditor picked it up without any fuss and hurried back to his room and locked the door. Dad stood, feet planted solidly on the floor, waiting for further provocation. He had started moving when a woman from the room of the third creditor said, "If you're so powerful, why don't you join the army?" "If I join the army," said Dad, whirling round, "your husband will be the first person I will shoot." I trembled. No one else ventured to say anything. Dad waited for someone to speak. The wind swept harder through the passage. The mosquitoes fell on him. The silence deepened and the darkness became indistinguishable from the different room. A child started crying. Someone smacked it and it cried even louder. Other babies woke and cried, and then one by one the crying ceased and the compound fell asleep. Dad came back in. He sat on his chair. His boots stood in their proper place except that the third creditor had mischievously displayed his socks so that the holes were visible. The center table was slightly out of place and I put it in its proper position. Dad rested his feet on the table. Then he lit a cigarette. Mom had been sitting on the bed, her face stony, her eyes deep, her hands ahead as though she were witnessing the beginning of a tragedy. Dad's feet stank and I noticed that his one shoe was falling apart. "No food?" he asked in a gentle voice. Mom passed his food. Dad washed his hands, beckoned us to join him, and ate. I didn't feel hungry anymore, and neither did Mom. Dad ate alone. He had a wonderful appetite, and when he finished, there was only cracked bones left on the plate. Then my hunger returned, and I regretted not eating with him. Mom cleared the plate. I cleared the table and spread out my mat. Dad lit another cigarette and a mosquito coil and sat still. He went on smoking, and it was only when I was falling asleep that I noticed one of his chair's feet was broken. Dad slept on the three-legged chair, and I watched his jaw lower and his face relax. He was awoken by his sudden fall. I showed no sign of having noticed. He got up grumbling. He blew out the candle and climbed into bed beside Mom. The next morning, no one spoke to us in the compound. Dad went off to work early and suffered nothing of the whisperings that followed us everywhere or the silence that greeted us when we went to the backyard. Mom bore it all very well. She said her greetings to people when she passed them and her face remained impassive when they didn't reply. She bore it all as if she were used to that treatment all her life. It was harder on me though. The children stared at me with sour faces and made it clear they didn't want my company. The compound people became united in their dislike of us. We were eating some pap and bread in the room when Mom said, "From today I will start at the market. One woman allowed me to rent her stall. I will not go hawking very much anymore." I was pleased at the news. Mom fondled my hair. "Now, go to school and afterwards stay at Madame Koto's place till I come for you, eh?" "Yes, Mother. I will be locking the door and taking the key so that no one will be able to do anything strange to us when we are away." I nodded. But as we prepared to leave the room, there was a knock on our door. Mom opened it and found the landlord standing outside. "Tell your husband," he said, without the slightest formality, "that if he repeats what he did last night, I will throw him out. I don't care if he is called Black Cricket. I myself am a lion. If necessary, I will send my boys to beat him up." if he gives me any more trouble, if he borrows money from anybody in this compound again, if he threatens to burn down my house, he better go and find himself another landlord, you hear? Mom didn't say anything. Her face was stony. The landlord went down the passage and we saw him go into the room of the second creditor. He emerged shortly afterwards with two of the creditors. The landlord, surrounded by the women and children of the compound, relieved himself of a lengthy speech about the difficulty of building houses, about tenants more terrible than that he had destroyed, and about how powerful he was. "If anybody gives me any trouble," he said, waving a fetish around, "I will show them that trouble is my secret name. Tiger or no tiger, this is my compound. I did not steal the money to build it." And then he bustled out of the compound with the women and children trailing behind him. Mom waited in the room for some time before she hurried out with her tray of provisions on her head. I went out with her. She locked the door and without waiting to escort me to the junction, she shot off in the opposite direction to the one the landlord had taken. She did not call out her wares and I watched her as she disappeared from view. Without any pocket money or any slice of bread, I lingered. I did not like going to school. I was late already and knew I would be publicly punished, whipped in front of everyone, and made to kneel out in the sun. I went to the house front instead. The compound women came out with chairs and plaited their hair and gossiped. It was from them that I first heard the rumors about Madame Couture. The women talked quite crisply about our relationship with her. They talked and kept eyeing me maliciously. They said of Madame Couture that she had buried 3 husbands and 7 children and that she was a witch who ate her babies when they were still in her womb. They said she was the real reason why the children in the area didn't grow, why they were always ill, why the men never got promotions, and why the women in the area suffered miscarriages. They said she was a bewitcher of husbands and a seducer of young boys and a poisoner of children. They said she had a charmed beard and that she plucked one hair out every day and dropped it into the palm wine she sold and into the pepper soup she made so that the men would spend all their money in her bar and not care about their starving families. They said she made men go insane at night and that she belonged to a secret society that flies about in the air when the moon is out. I got tired of hearing what they had to say and I decided that being punished at school was infinitely better.